Welcome to the Catholic Man Show. I am David Niles. I just have to tell you guys, I missed you, okay? I know that you missed me too, but I missed you. I was gone for the last couple weeks on vacation with my family. It was awesome. We were in Michigan where it's not hot. It's hot in Oklahoma. It's not hot in Michigan. It was good. So, as luck would have it, this week Adam is on vacation. Not a scheduled thing, that's just the way it worked out. So I have with me today my friend Harrison Garlick.
Hello.
He is a man.
Yes, it's true.
He is Catholic.
Also true.
He's the chancellor of our diocese. He's a knower of things, a haver of beards, and a drinker of whiskey. So
I think I qualify for the show.
Yeah, I mean, that's really all you need. So, I mean, it's, not everybody qualifies, okay? In fact, before we go any further, we need to give out the warning. Warning. If you are someone who is susceptible to high levels of manliness, you need to do something else. Turn this show off, because this show will be harmful to your health. Please consult your doctor before listening, because, like, I don't want your brain to explode, or you just, like, maybe you don't like chest hair. I don't know. Because if you listen to the show, you're going to definitely get more of it. Anyway, you're warned. This is for manly men only. So, Harrison.
Yes.
We're drinking your favorite whiskey today.
We are. We are drinking Laphroaig Scotch. It's a single malt scotch. It's very, very good. It's a peated scotch. And we have the quarter cask, which is an additional bonus.
Boom. So a quarter cask is like, there's a regular cask.
Right.
Which is like a barrel of wood. Quarter cask is a fourth the size.
Yes.
So it increases the wood surface ratio.
To the actual whiskey.
For the whiskey, yeah. So it's more in contact with the wood. Gives it a specific
Yeah, it should
flavor.
Give it a little bit. It should smooth it out, I think, a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a peated whiskey. So for those who aren't familiar with that, the number one kind of peated whiskeys, scotches, are Laphroaig and Lagavulin. So peat is, it's a very acquired taste.
Mm-hmm.
Peat is
for
actually
sure.
A moss. So just imagine, so you got Scotland, and imagine
okay.
that Scotland has...
I don't even have to imagine it.
No.
It's a real thing.
Okay.
Okay.
So, and it's covered in bogs, basically, right? So these bogs will dry up over time and dry out, and they kind of stack on each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they learned you could do is you just can go in and basically cut out these briskets of this dried up mosque bog, and they can burn it for fuel. So
because there's no wood.
Right.
There's very little wood in
exactly.
Ireland. So I've tried this once before. The last time I tried it, I didn't like it. But I was a much greener whiskey drinker at the time. And lately, this is going to work out perfect. Lately, I've found myself saying, you know, I think I like the smokier whiskey more.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a couple different ones here, and my go-to is typically not the smokier one, but over the last few months, I've been saying, no, I think I am going to drink that one.
Well, I think one of the points of the show is actually to increase your masculinity, so I think that...
I'll bet that's why.
This is a man's drink. That's what this says right here.
So... This is, I just have to tell this, the marketing for Laphroaig, I think, is awesome. It's basically, they do all these YouTube videos, and they give people some Laphroaig, but before I continue, let's just drink some. We're on the Lord's team, the winning side, so raise your glass. Cheers to Jesus.
Cheers.
And Our Lady. It is way better than the last time I had it.
It's so good. So for those who have never had Laphroaig and unfortunately also can't join us in this drink, most of the time when people try Laphroaig for the first time, this nice peated scotch, generally the flavors they come up with is like it tastes like a warm Band-Aid,
mm-hmm.
An electrical fire,
mm-hmm.
Kind of like a ground-up Sharpie in
nice,
a coal mine.
Like some bark in
yeah,
the background.
Exactly. So basically what happens is they take up this dried out moss, this peat,
mm-hmm.
and they burn it to dry out the barley grains. And so some scotches, like your Highlands, don't use any peat at all.
Right.
So they'll stay very smooth and sweet, et cetera. But with your peated scotches, they'll use peat for the majority of the drying process, and that's where this very distinct flavor comes from.
There is just a lot going on in this whiskey. It's going to take me several sips, before I can really get my hands totally around it. Do we have any of the tasting notes? Do you have... that's in here.
So I think so your show comes with a warning. I think Lafroy needs to come with its own warning, actually. Because someone turned me on to this a few years ago, and I will tell you, here's the problem, is if you get used to this flavor, which is, it is very earthy, right? It tastes like bark.
Mm.
My favorite description of it ever, I think I've heard, is this, imagine like an old man travels across the sea. And at the end of it, he just kind of like wrings out his leather jacket into a cup. And I think that's Lafroy. So here's your problem with that is it basically will make every other scotch and whiskey taste like a Jolly Rancher. Everything else will just taste very, very sweet. And people would be trying whiskeys and they're like, oh, I just can't handle this, whatever. And if you're used to Lafroy, this peated scotch, everything, it just tastes like honey. It's great.
So true to form. One thing about the Scotch and the Irish, really, all the Gaelic cultures, none of them know how to spell. Okay? Like, they just missed spelling, I guess. Lafroy is L-A-P-H-R-O-A-I-G. Lafroy. It's not Lafroig.
Or Laproig.
Laproig.
Not Laproig.
It's Lafroy. And we're drinking the quarter cask. They also just have the regular... 12, I guess.
Yeah, I think you're 10. Lafroy, actually, unlike like Lagavulin, there's not that many variations, but Lafroy actually has a very wide selection of scotches that you can choose from, which I would highly recommend all of them.
So if you've had a scotch, you've had, most likely, something with peat. However, this is different because it is heavily, heavily peated.
Yeah, some of them. So the Islay scotches, so you got your Highlands, your Islays, and a few others. Your Highlands generally won't use like any peat in the process at all.
Zero.
Zero.
Okay.
And so their burning process is very different. And then you can get things like, so we were talking about casks earlier. They'll put it in like a port cask, right? And so it's very sweet. And so your scotches come out and they're very, they're still scotch, but they have like these really heavy sweet tones to them. So obviously scotch has a very wide gamut.
Sure.
But this is, if you like the kind of kick you in the face, smoky kind of bark, very masculine drink, I think the peated scotches are going to be where you are comfortable.
So you also mentioned Lagavulin.
Yeah.
I think those are probably the two...
Those are like the two flagship peated scotches.
Flagship, that's a good word for the...
You've got some
of these varieties.
You've got some other ones, and you've got some like novelty ones like that have tried to make peat itself like its selling point, so they just kind of like overdo it, right? Mm-hmm. Trying to have more peat as possible.
Right.
But when you're looking just for quality scotches that really do the peated whiskey well, I think Lafroy and Lagavulin are your best choices. Mm-hmm.
So a friend of mine, he says he's got a bottle of Octomore. I'm not sure if I said that right. That's at least how I think he says it, Octomore.
We can blame it on him if it's wrong.
Yeah, Ken teaching me how to say things. Hopefully correct. Apparently, that is the most heavily peated scotch. I've never had it.
I haven't either.
I would guess, you know how like you can go to the store and buy like liquid smoke?
Right.
It's probably a lot like that. So
you probably just get peat moss itself. And just kind of warm it up.
Just
and
put it in the blender with a little bit of water.
It's kind of like wheatgrass.
Give it a try. Yeah. It's probably great for you.
It is. I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, no, it's this is definitely my favorite. I think, you know, in the summer, I think it could be a little rough because I think it lends itself to, like, kind of cold weather, rainy days.
Totally.
Again, Scotland. But just throughout the year, I think it's a great choice.
And we are drinking these out of our Glencairn glasses.
Right.
So... The aromas are particularly precise.
You know, you mentioned the, if you guys want to see how people react to Lafroy the first time.
Yeah, the YouTube videos.
Yeah, the YouTube videos are phenomenal. You mentioned them. So Lafroy did this whole marketing scheme of just hiring I think they were actors, just people who had never tried it before, putting them around a table and just having, recording their initial reactions.
Right.
And it is hysterical. Some of them take it very nicely, and like, oh yeah, I can tell this is kind of a smoky flavor. There's this one grandmotherly lady who's just like, yeah, I think this reminds me of formaldehyde, right? Like, I can't do this. I think they came up with some other good ones, too. It tastes like the bathroom doorknob at a dive bar that's been drugged through a field of flowers. So there's some pretty creative things to it, but watching their facial expressions, too, try it for the first time.
Yeah. It's like there are some who said, oh, that's really good. But then a lot of them are just going, that's the worst thing I've ever had. I hate it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't ever give that to me again. But then even those people, as they sipped on it for a little bit, by the end, they kind of like, well, maybe it's not so bad. Let me try it again. No, it's still bad.
Right. Well, I mean, you're running at 48% alcohol. So like, I think the more you try it, the more you're going to end up liking it.
It's 48%.
I believe so.
Okay. So that's 96 proof.
So you, it actually gets better as you continue to, so you don't like it on the first sip, just drink a few glasses and you'll love it. It'll
right.
be fantastic.
Yeah, because you won't taste anything.
Right. So, but no, it's very, very good. I enjoy it. It's not, it's probably not a drink that you bring to parties.
Yeah, unless you wanted nobody else to drink.
That's true. Actually, it could be a brilliant choice for parties if you want to show that you actually brought something to contribute.
Do you remember that, like, Doritos commercial where they were, like, selling this fake sleeve to put over your Doritos, like to take to the party, that
exactly.
way no one would eat your Doritos.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of like what this is.
Yeah, so you can just, you know, bring it. And I do have one rule. So I usually have Lafroig at the house, and I'll generally just have it where if you want something else, I'll have you smell it first,
and if you like the smell, then you can drink it. Well, we are out of time for this segment. We'll be right back with our man gear. We're on the Lord's team, the winning side, so raise your glass. Enjoy the commercials. Welcome back to the Catholic Man Show. We are flying at full altitude, enjoying a lovely glass of Lafroig. Can you do a good Irish accent?
Wouldn't you do Scottish for this?
I'm sorry. Scottish accent.
Either way, Irish, Scottish, no. I cannot do it. I just know it's Lafroig.
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 I pretend like I do, because most people I don't think can tell the difference.
I think if you just say it fast enough with some kind of accent.
Sure.
And judging on the spelling, most people won't correct you.
Lafroig.
Right. So there's actually a series of YouTube videos of just one guy sitting down and saying, like, 100 different types of Scotch names, just so you actually know how it's supposed to be.
I've seen that guy.
He's an actor.
Yeah,
what is his name? I don't remember.
I don't remember his name, but I've used those YouTube videos. There's been some of these that we've had on the Man Show where it's like Adam and I are looking at each other going, I have no idea how to pronounce this. And so we just Google it, and a YouTube video comes up, and it's just a guy going, Lafroig.
It's like 3 seconds long, and then it ends.
Lafroig.
Yeah. No, it's so if you ever want to know how to pronounce it, YouTube, it's phenomenal.
Yeah. It is. It's crazy. It's like, surely nobody has dedicated time to professionally producing a YouTube video where all they do is pronounce this one word. But they have.
They have. You know, another good video is, we're drinking Lafroig, but speaking of just peated scotches, is the guy who, on the Parks and Recreation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He made Lagavulin basically famous, because that's what he drinks in the show. What is his name again? I'm trying to remember.
On the show, it is, if you hadn't asked me, I'd have been able to tell you, because I was just talking about this video with Adam the other day.
Yeah, so in the show, he actually goes to the Lagavulin distillery. Ron Swanson.
Ron Swanson, yeah.
Right. Yeah, the Pyramid of Manhood, or whatever that is. We should have that on a show sometime. So he actually has on YouTube an hour and a half video of just him sitting in a chair by a fireplace drinking scotch.
Incomplete,
and nothing else.
In complete silence.
Yeah. He just sits there and enjoys it.
Yeah. It's just, it's the best.
You should actually have a man show like that where you just sit down and for an hour, your listeners just listen to you drink scotch.
So for the next 20 minutes, we're just going to enjoy nothing. We're going to enjoy quiet time brought to you by the Catholic Man Show. No, but seriously, the man gear for today is, in fact, the whiskey decanter.
Right.
And I've got one. before we started recording, I think you told me you have three.
I have three, yeah. So when my wife and I were married, I had already been living on my own for a while. And my family, for whatever reason, thought when I lived on my own, I was going to culinary school. So they actually had purchased me like a full kitchen, like everything you normally get when you are married. I already had everything. So when my wife and I were married, I had no idea what to put on like our registry, because we had like I was a bachelor and I had like the pan you cook a turkey in for Thanksgiving. Like I had everything. So my wife like got all these practical things. All I did was put on bar stuff on there. So I ended up with three.
Who could blame you?
Yeah. Well, it still worked out well.
Yeah.
So I've got two that have a G kind of etched into them, mm-hmm. really nice, and another kind of large one. And so they said all three are on my bar, and I really enjoy them.
So the one I have is also a wedding gift, because we invited like 600 people to our wedding. It was a big deal.
It's a good thing for gifts.
My wife and I, we both come from huge families, so it's like at some point you can only register for so many towels, you know. You only need so many towels. So it's like, all right, let's start registering for the cool stuff.
Like decanters.
Like decanters. So I got a nice crystal decanter. Before the show, I was looking up, you know, like, does this actually do anything? You know, it's like, because I put whiskey in it, but I just do it because it looks cool. Turns out, no, it doesn't do anything.
But it does look cool.
It does look cool.
It does look cool. And in my little bar, I just moved, so I'm kind of rearranging my bar. So I have three, and what I do with those is I actually think having a decanter, it does play into the overall just like having a bar and having your man gear, et cetera.
Right.
But I think it also plays into hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
Because,
right.
So again, I'm just going to say it over and over again, Laphroaig is one of my favorite scotches. Mm-hmm. However, it is probably one of the least favorite scotches of people who come to my house, right? Because if you're not used to peated flavor, you generally don't like it. If you smell it, you're generally like, no, thank you. Mm-hmm. I'll have, you know, bubblegum vodka or whatever it is that other people drink. So what I usually do is I have my decanters out, and I actually put in them kind of the top drinks that I think my guests would like.
Uh-huh.
And so I've learned that this actually works out very well, because normally when people come to your house and like, oh, do you want something to drink? And you're offering them some kind of alcohol. Most people just don't like rattle off something they want. They want to see, well, what do you have?
What do you have?
What do you have?
Yeah.
And so there's two things that I would recommend here. One is, I put in what do most people like that I'm willing to have in my house, because I think, as this show probably teaches you, there is certain man code. So you don't have bubblegum vodka in your bar, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have that. You certainly don't have it.
I mean, maybe for the kids.
maybe. So you probably don't have that in your bar. Certainly don't have it in your decanter. But, you know, just some general things that people tend to like. So it's the summer. So right now I have gin in one of mine. Uh-huh. So I'll offer people like gin and tonics with lime.
What gin do you have?
Hendrix.
Okay.
Hendrix.
The only time I've ever had gin that wasn't like Bombay Sapphire. You know, it's like
Bombay Sapphire.
You know, some of those, there's some gins out there that are like any variety of fruit flavored.
Right.
To me, if you drink that and then you just drink gin,
mm-hmm.
it's like two totally different things.
Yeah. So in general, just, you know, as far as man code goes, I think anything that tends to be fruit flavored is probably outside of the purview of man code.
Well said.
Hendrix it's a pretty good rule of thumb, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it's peat moss flavored, then you're perfectly fine.
But that's not a fruit, so I think we're all right.
Exactly. So Hendrix doesn't market itself this way, but it has the way they make it. It has a slight cucumber.
I was
going to
ask if that was the one that's made out of cucumbers.
It has a slight under... It's not like... Most people won't drink it and say, oh, there's cucumbers here. But what it does is it has a slight undertone that's very refreshing.
Uh-huh.
And so most people will try and identify it. And then if you tell them, well, it's cucumber, then they actually put two and two together.
Because they make it out of cucumbers, don't they?
Something along those lines.
Yeah, I think they do. And it's like a new discovery that... It's like in our lifetime that some guy discovered you can make gin out of cucumbers. And it like blew everybody's mind and said... This is the best gin I've ever had.
I'll totally take your word for it.
That's a story I heard one time.
Okay.
And
it was on a meme on the internet.
So therefore, it's got to be infallible, because I heard it.
Exactly.
Do you put that in a...
Yeah, so I just put Hendrix in there, because it's a summer, so a lot of people. So we'll put like gin and tonic or soda water, et cetera. It's a very light, refreshing drink for guests.
Right.
So I think the decanters can play in very heavily just the hospitality. And the other thing I would recommend along is just having the most popular drinks that you're willing to offer in your decanters would be always have a drink already made for yourself when mm-hmm. your guests come over. And this sounds really weird, because it sounds like you're serving yourself first. But 9 times out of 10, if you ask people, well, do you want a drink? The first thing they do is they look at what you're drinking.
Right.
And if you don't have a drink, most people feel like they're imposing on you if, like, they would, like, you have to go make them one.
Right.
So generally I've learned that if I just have my own drink out, then they usually look at it and say, one, what are you drinking?
And two, what do you have?
Two, okay. The two comes up generally if, like, I'm drinking Lafroig, for example. Most people are like, no, thank you. But then they're like, well, what else do you have? So it still kind of transitions. And then sometimes, too, if I'm having people over, we're going to have, like, a thematic drink, like, for the evening.
Sure.
So gin and tonics or Bloody Marys or whatever it is, right, if you're having brunch.
Right.
I'll go ahead and make myself one. And I might just have that one and then go back and default to whatever it is I generally like, but I'll have one for myself.
Mm-hmm.
So when they come over and they just naturally, I think it makes your guests feel a lot more comfortable.
Mm-hmm. What I typically do is say, like, for the first guest who arrives, oh, I was just about to get a beer. Do you want something to drink? Or I was just about to pour myself some whiskey. Do you want anything to drink? We've got this and this. And that works. I think it works the same. But I am, like, getting really pumped listening to the things that you said, because I just realized I need more decanters.
That's actually the thesis of the show. So to be a good Catholic and very Benedictine, actually, and be hospitable,
that's right.
You need to go buy more decanters.
Do you think that will be on the quiz at our judgment?
I think so. It's like,
how many did you have and what did you put in them?
When you had guests over, your decanter selection was actually pretty weak.
Yeah. Look at the terrible position you put your guests in.
I think that's Matthew 25, I think. I think that's how it works out.
Yeah, something like that.
But no, I do think it kind of goes, decanters kind of just go into having an overall bar setup and also kind of having things. You can also have things around the house. So, for instance, if you have, like, my wife and I are very big about the first room that people walk into, if you have, like, a sitting room or some kind of den, it does not have a TV in it, right? So you kind of engage, and it's set up for conversations.
Correct.
Generally, I would say even if your main bar is not in that area, have a decanter, right? Like you said, you have a crystal decanter. Have that with maybe some matching glasses, et cetera, and have that in the room. So if you are just sitting down, you can say, oh, would you like a drink of, you know, whatever you have on hand there? And it kind of, you know, it helps elaborate conversations and et cetera. And I think it's pretty good.
Because, Harrison, my wife won't let me leave my alcohol selection out on the counter in the kitchen. We don't have a bar area. She won't let me do that. But she will let me leave the decanter out.
I know, but I noticed the decanter is hiding in the corner.
It's in the corner. Hey, but it's there. But I think that's important because it says something like kind of what you were saying, like, oh, I don't want to impose, you know, you have to get out and make me a drink.
Right.
You know, if I have to go open up the cabinets and, you know, get out a bottle or something, it kind of does have that feeling for the guest that, oh, he wasn't planning on serving this, but I asked for it. So now, you know, I feel bad.
Right. Or if all, like, your alcohol is, like, hidden in some weird cabinet that most people don't even know opens in your kitchen.
Sure.
It doesn't kind of lend itself.
And maybe you don't want to expose that cabinet anyway.
Right.
You know, maybe you want to keep it a secret.
Yeah, I mean, it's perfectly acceptable to have, like, all your good stuff hidden somewhere else.
Right.
You know, that's fine.
Yeah. But, you know, if it's out here, oh, it's just right here. Boom. There you go. I think that really is something, it's a more natural process, I think, for your guests. And as men, it really is important that we practice and make that virtue, which is the exact name of which is escaping me right now, but just when someone comes over, you want to make them feel welcome.
Hospitality.
Thank you. That is a manly virtue, and it's something you need to practice and be prepared for. Hospitality doesn't just happen. So anyway, we're on the Lord's team, the winning side, so raise your glass. We'll be right back. Welcome back, that is, to the Catholic Man Show. Over the break, Harrison and I accomplished many feats of strength, which are possibly too strong to be named here, including sips of whiskey. We could name that.
That's true.
Feats of strength on the Catholic Man Show. So, the topic today, we're in the second half of the show, this is where we get real, is the diaconate.
Yes.
This is obviously a manly topic, because the diaconate is only for men, similar to the priesthood. because Jesus was a dude. That's kind of important.
I've heard that, yeah.
Yeah. If you say that, oh, maybe women should be priests, you have to ask the question, was it important that Jesus came as a man and not a woman? Did it matter? Was that just like a random choice? You know, I think it matters. Not what this subject is about. I just wanted to open that can of worms and throw it.
Right. So.
And then just go totally different direction.
So circling back to the diaconate. Yeah. So the diaconate is an absolutely wonderful vocation. So it's part of Holy Order. So we'll kind of start discussing what that is. So Holy Orders is one of the sacraments, obviously, of Mother Church. And these are the people, these are individuals that receive a special grace, an indelible mark upon their soul, actually, to fill out their vocation. Now, we see this in other things too, right? So when you are married, right, you receive a grace to actually live the married life. This is what the sacraments give us, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a visible sign of an invisible grace. So when we're talking about holy orders then, they're receiving this grace, the indelible mark upon their soul. What does this actually mean? So it means that they're each going to receive a grace to help them carry out the vocation. There's three degrees of holy orders. You have your bishop, you have your priest, and you have your deacon. So your bishop, you know, our bishop, our local bishop here in the Diocese of Tulsa, he is our shepherd.
New bishop. Bishop David.
Bishop David Condorla, right? Phenomenal, very personable. Driving around eastern Oklahoma in a small silver pickup truck with a camper on the back.
Have you seen it, though? It looks legit.
It's awesome.
Looks like it could, like, definitely run over some boulders.
I think he's the kind of guy that, very, very simple life. He could just camp out in the back of the camper and be perfectly content. He wants to spend time with people in the diocese, go to potlucks, meet people. You know, the shepherd wants to know his sheep. I think it's very wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So in his vocation to do that, right, he's being our shepherd, he receives this full grace of Jesus Christ, right? He is, in many ways, Jesus Christ to us in this area, leading us into the kingdom. In a similar way, you see with priests, they only participate partially in that grace, but the grace that they're participating in is Christ the High Priest. So this is why we call them priests. This is why in the Reformation they got away from the term priest, because priest denotes sacrifice. If you have a priest, you always have a sacrifice.
Right.
So we call our priests because of the holy sacrifice of the Mass, right?
Mm-hmm.
You'll see this in, maybe not so much in our country, but in a lot of other countries, you'll see people after Mass, and when they meet priests, they will kiss their hands.
Right.
Because these are the hands that bring us the Blessed Eucharist, right? The Holy Eucharist. So they participate in that grace to be a priest, to bring us the sacrifice. And also the other priestly act is confession, taking your sins and the reparation of your sins. So these are definitely priestly acts.
I'm really glad they can
do
that.
Yeah, it's very handy. It's very handy.
Really needed that one a few times.
Yeah. So then you have the deacon. I think this is sometimes where the waters get muddied, as people don't understand exactly what is the diaconate. Sometimes it's just like, well, I think it's what you serve as a deacon for like 6 months before you become a priest, right?
Right.
It's like this weird pre-priest season that you have to go through.
It's like priest light.
And everyone's like, okay, we're not going to get too excited about this ordination because the quote-unquote real
the
ordination
real one, yeah, is
in coming up
6
later.
Months.
Right.
And for some of our older listeners, you know, they'll remember a time when permanent deacons weren't necessarily very very common.
No, and you know, Vatican II had to completely kind of restore the permanent diaconate, and we'll get to that.
Restore, I think, is a key word.
I think it is a key word, actually. So the deacons, then, what they're participating in, what is the grace that they receive? They are actually participating in Christ the suffering servant.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they are. So deacon actually comes from the word to mean servant. So what we see is in the early church, we see in the very beginning of Acts a very, very clear call of the deacons.
Mm-hmm.
So you have what became the bishops, right? The people that had received the full grace, the apostles going out. And they could actually celebrate the Mass. They could go and celebrate. But what they couldn't do is they couldn't administer the church. They couldn't actually go out and be with the people. They couldn't run all the programs, right?
Right.
Like feeding the poor and taking care of the
orphan. And I think that's what they're actually talking about in Acts. They say, hey, you know, there's these widows who are being neglected, you know.
Exactly.
Because just the priests didn't have time is what it came down to.
Yeah, the bishops, you know, the apostles really did not have time, and so they said, you know, we need to have these servants, we need to have these helpers, and so this is the grace that our deacons are participating in, is that they are servants. Their entire life should be characterized by servant leadership,
mm-hmm.
whether that is, you know, they always tell you, when you become ordained, it's not how many servants you get, right? It's like, oh, now I'm a bishop, now I'm a priest, now I'm a deacon. It's not how many servants you get when you become ordained. It's that you actually are making a pledge, an oath, to be a servant
right.
to everyone around you. So over time, what happened when you see in Acts, you see these deacons come up and they're serving the church. In a lot of ways, they actually administered a lot of the church's programs and ran the church. You actually see them coming in before the priesthood as well. Now, this, not to confuse things, obviously you have the apostles and they have the full grace, so you already have priests, you have
sure.
a mass.
Right.
But the concept of there being another part of holy orders, someone that could also go and celebrate mass in another area that wasn't a bishop. You don't really get that until later on, before 100 AD, but generally most people say around like 90 or so.
Really?
That the church starts to grow enough where the local bishop can't say mass in all the areas. Because usually you're looking at like a home church.
Right,
with
not, in the beginning.
In the beginning with not very many people. And so the deacons actually came first in a certain way to help serve. And so that's an important historical note, because what ended up happening is that because the deacons came first and their role was really to go out, serve, and administer, is that over time, when the bishops needed priests, they said, okay, I need another priest to come in and do priestly things, right? Sacrifice, mm-hmm. confession. Who can I make a priest? Well, you already got this whole pool of deacons over here that's serving the church and doing everything
else. Pretty holy dude.
Exactly. So it's like, okay, well, why don't we take one of these deacons who's already shown himself to be competent in serving the poor and et cetera, and we will give him an additional grace. We will ordain him to the priesthood to be able to celebrate the sacrifice of the Mass and to hear confessions, right, these priestly acts. What happened was, I mean, the joke is that deacons became too good at their job. And what happened is that over
classic.
Time in the church, right, happens to the best of us,
right?
So what happened in the church is that they realized, okay, well, it's actually always good for priests to have this experience, to be these servants. So more and more the bishops continually leaned on the diaconate to supply the priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time you get to about 1000 AD, you're really getting into a culture in which you really only become a deacon with the end goal of finally becoming a priest.
I see.
So the diaconate became a preparation for the priesthood. So what Vatican II tried to do is and said, hey, let's discern this and realize, is there a separate individual calling of the diaconate separate from the priesthood?
Right.
Can you go out and be Christ, the suffering servant to people, but also not celebrate the Mass and hear confession?
Mm-hmm.
And so Vatican II called for a restoration of the permanent diaconate.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's kind of like Jesus looking at the diaconate and saying, in the beginning, it was not so. which he said about other sacraments, I'll just say that.
Right. So what happens is you get this call from Vatican II to kind of restore the diaconate. And I think the last couple of decades have really been marked by a lot of discernment of what this actually looks like and what this actually means.
Uh-huh.
The Catechism is very clear that these permanent diacons now don't have to be celibate. So
mm-hmm.
married men who are already engaging in the sacrament of holy matrimony can actually come forward and present themselves to be formed in service, to be formed in the diaconate, to hopefully then one day be ordained as deacons. And so kind of returning to this three-tiered sacrament of holy orders, you see the bishops, and they have the full grace. You see the priests, and they have this priestly grace, Christ the High Priest, to participate in the sacrifice of the Mass and confession. And then you have the deacons, and they are called to be servants. They are called to actually be with the people in many ways, and also to help run a lot of the church's programs that actually does a service to the church.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the greatest benefits we're seeing of this is that if deacons are running all these programs, that gives more and more time for priests to actually be amongst the people, hearing confessions, saying Mass, etc.
Right.
That, you know, as a deacon you can't do.
Mm-hmm. And I think particularly here in Tulsa, we are a missionary diocese, which means, you know, we don't have a whole lot of Catholics running around, which means we have fewer priests running around. The deacons, the diaconate serves a very important role because, you know, it's not like the old days where there's three priests at every parish.
Right.
That we need more people who can do things, you know, like help with adoration, you know.
Correct.
Who's going to start adoration and who's going to do the closing, that kind of thing.
And who's going to have, you know, other times like baptisms, funerals.
Right.
Really anything outside of what's connected directly to the sacrifice of the Mass and confession.
So when we get back, we're going to talk a little bit more about Harrison's personal story and about you. If you are thinking about maybe I should be a deacon, what are some things that you should consider? So in the meantime, we're on the Lord's team, the winning side. So raise your glass and raise it high. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Catholic Man Show. This hour is progressing quickly. We're in the last segment. I'm sitting here with Harrison Garlick, Chancellor of the Tulsa Diocese, as well as like a thousand other things, I think. It's like maybe unofficially at least. It seems like every time I talk to you, it's like, oh yeah, I got put in charge of this. Oh, and I'm running this whole thing over here. Oh, and I got asked to start this.
So chancellors are a weird breed. We should have a whole show just on that. But so under canon law, chancellors are actually just in charge of the archives. That's it.
Well, you're in charge. I just know you're in charge more than that.
I am, because it's just like a good job description. Canon law is like, oh, you're in charge of the archives and all other duties as assigned. So, you know,
and whatever else we tell you to
do. And whatever, you know, His Excellency says, go do this.
And you started off as a vice chancellor.
I did. So it's been a whirlwind
whatever
year.
That means.
Right. So obviously vice chancellor.
Did they make it
chancellor.
Up? Did they make that up?
Kind of. Yeah. My job was vice chancellor for operations and religious formation. That's probably not in most dioceses. So
probably not.
But now I'm privileged to serve as chancellor. I'm very humbled to do so. You know, kind of in the Anglo world, when we hear chancellor, we're kind of formed by the British mindset where chancellor has to be like...
Or Star Wars.
Or Star Wars, yeah, Emperor Palpatine, got it. Mm-hmm. So basically, there are several departments I help out at the chancery. I work with Father Elkin Gonzalez, who's our vicar general.
He's awesome.
He is very awesome.
I was at his house today. I didn't see him.
He's a very, very, very wonderful man.
That sounded weird. I was at the rectory where he lives with several other priests. I was there with another, my brother-in-law who lives there. It's not like I was just at some guy's house when he wasn't there.
Who is a priest.
Who is a priest, right, yeah.
Yeah, so in our diocese, the chancellor helps out basically with the whole operations and organization of the diocese. Mm-hmm. And very privileged to serve the bishop that way and do whatever he needs me to do so he can be a shepherd and go out and see his flock, his people, and spend time with them. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I feel very blessed to be where I am. I'm also an attorney, and then I have a few degrees in theology, and so I found like the one job on the planet that actually cares about both of those.
And just like a few degrees in theology,
right? So like when I was like working at a law firm, they'd be like, "Oh, what'd you say beforehand? Theology," and that killed all conversation.
It's like, and now you want to be a lawyer,
right? Like, are you okay? So I feel very blessed to be.
And you're a dad and a husband.
I am a dad, a husband, and I am a diaconate candidate.
Correct.
So we'll circle
which
back
is
to that.
Why we picked the topic
exactly
for today.
So I'll tell you a little bit about my story and trying to discern. So kind of talking about my background might be a good introduction. So I studied theology at Oral Roberts University as a Protestant, became very interested in the Catholic faith through history and really trying to understand the relationship between faith and reason. I still remember reading Pope John Paul II's Fides et Ratio, just the opening paragraph, really, but faith and reason are the two wings mm-hmm. upon which man ascends to God.
Right.
I had no idea how to interpret that from my previous Protestant background, which is very charismatic. And so faith is something that generally has to trump the intellect to a certain degree.
Right.
Reason is something that has to be suppressed.
That's why it's faith. You just got to believe.
Right. You just believe. It's always uh-huh. blind. It's like Luther, right? Luther, reason is a whore. It's the greatest enemy that faith has. Right. Mm-hmm. We use it too much. So I actually had no idea how to interpret.
And he was wrong.
Yeah, he was wrong.
Yeah, he was very wrong.
Many things.
Yeah.
So I had no idea how to interpret that. And so I was like, well, I don't really know what a pope is or what Catholicism is, but this statement is intriguing to me.
Mm-hmm.
How do you explain this? So that actually led me from Oral Roberts University to being very interested in the Catholic faith, particularly in the relationship of faith and reason. And I ended up going to Ave Maria University in Florida, which was deeply entrenched in Thomistic theology, right? Studying the Summa, studying
okay.
St. Thomas Aquinas.
Good stuff.
Fantastic stuff. And that really kind of met my need. It fed that hunger in my soul to understand how is faith and reason.
So still as a Protestant?
Yes. Yeah. I still went there as a Protestant, yeah. And so they really, every class was...
And
really,
they let you in.
They did. And I was like the weird Protestant kid that went to this like very like deeply, like they're usually rated like the number one Catholic school in the country and Catholic identity.
Wow.
It's like, why are you here? Do you understand where you are right now?
Right.
So I remember I took this priest that was running the program out to breakfast and asked him if I could join the program. And he was in a whole nother world. Like he entered the monastery when he was like 12. He wrote his master's thesis in Latin. So, I mean, he was like on a whole different level. And I just remember here's this like little kid from Oral Roberts University saying, can I please study Catholic faith? And I had no previous understanding of like sacraments or the church, anything that you would understand like an undergraduate you would need to bring as
wow.
foundation. And probably because of the grace of God, they let me in. And I went in full bore. I loved it. I found my home. I found Jesus Christ. I found his church. I came into the church in between graduate years. And actually with my wife now, my girlfriend at the time, we went through RCI together.
So kind that's of, very cool.
It was actually. That's, it's actually,
sounds almost romantic.
It is. And she's a lot prettier than a girl that I should have been able to get. And so everyone always thinks that she was Catholic.
Yeah.
Right? She's just like...
Oh, yeah. You must have converted
exactly,
for her.
Exactly. They always naturally... They see both of us, and I'm like, oh, I'm a convert. And the next thing out of their mouth is, oh, so you must have been Catholic. I'm like, I understand what that means, just for the record.
I get it. She's prettier than me, okay?
Right. I got
okay.
it. I married up. I got it. I'm not going to argue with you, but I... You know, let's cool it a little bit. So so then I graduated with a master's in theology, and also became Catholic. You know, married life hits you, trying to figure out how to support a family,
right.
and then going to law school and graduating. And so in somewhere around the middle of law school, I was teaching RCIA. I loved serving the church, but it didn't seem enough. There was mm-hmm. there was a hunger in my soul that I couldn't placate. I actually took my Monsignor at my parish out to lunch and said, I think how I described to him was, I was like, there is a splinter in the back of my mind that will not leave me alone. And it says, I'm not serving enough.
Right.
And I don't know what that looks like because I'm about to drive my family crazy by going to law school, all the burdens of that, interning at firms and hospitals and judges, et cetera, and then also teaching RCIA and helping out the parish. I actually don't know how to give more of myself. I don't know how
sure.
to empty myself more.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that I feel God calling me to do that. And he said, well, what about the diaconate program? And it just hit me like a bunch of bricks in the face because I was like, you mean that program for retired men?
Right.
Like, what?
Yeah.
What? No, Monsignor, I have not discern the diaconate. I don't even know what you mean, really. So he kind of helped me.
I'm not even 30 yet.
Right, yeah. I'm like, I'm not even like, I should be at least like 60, right, before I even start discerning.
Uh-huh.
So I was like, I'm going to have a kid. So what he helped me understand was that this was not just like a second calling. This was not just something that you do when you're like, well, I've done all my other obligations in life. What else could I do? What other mm-hmm. hobby could I pick up, right?
Right.
This was actually a call responding to the Holy Spirit mm-hmm. of service, right? If that's what the deacon is, a servant, then there's some, and many of us in our hearts, there's a call to serve more. So he said, you need to look at the diaconate program, and I did. And I started discerning it, and it just really struck me. I was like, wow, this really is a community. This really is a fraternity, actually,
right.
of brothers who are coming together from all walks of life, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have people who have graduate degrees in theology. We have people who just graduated from high school. We have people from very, very small towns. We have people from the metro. they're all bonded together by a service to Jesus Christ and a service to his church and service to neighbor,
mm-hmm.
saying, how can I give more of myself? I'm very blessed, too, probably providentially, to be in the Diocese of Tulsa. And you said we're a small mission diocese, but we probably have taken our diaconate more seriously than many other countries, not just dioceses in the United States. We have a six-year program that basically ends up terminating in 840 classroom hours.
Wow.
And that includes praxis, like a liturgical praxis,
mm-hmm.
counseling, formation in the sacraments, formation in Scripture. We also have a whole year just dedicated to philosophy, understanding like Plato, Aristotle, etc. You know, because deacons are part of holy orders, and that's another good point to probably point out, they are also clerics. They're mm-hmm. clergy.
Right.
So the Diocese of Tulsa is also one of the few dioceses where their deacons actually wear clerics,
mm-hmm.
right? They wear...
They wear a collar, just
they
like
wear
a priest.
Collar.
Yeah.
Slightly different, right? So the priest has the notch in the middle. The deacons in our diocese are wearing a collar that has traditionally been subscribed to brothers, particularly like you look at the Jesuit order.
Okay.
So it doesn't have a notch in the middle, but it's a collar full way around. Sometimes it's called the dog collar. Sometimes it's a little different. So here are these men I see in the community that are leading church organizations.
Right.
They're serving at the altar. They're married. They have children. And they're balancing all of these things in their life, but they're living virtuous lives mm-hmm. in sacrifice and service. And that really struck me. And
so, you know, we just got a few minutes left, and I've got a couple of hard questions for you. Because these are the questions that I had. And when, in fact, when I met you, I was kind of surprised. Like, you're, you know, a diaconate. You know, you're in the program.
Right, your beard isn't even gray.
Right, exactly. Because, like, once you become a deacon, if your wife dies, you can't get remarried. And if you've got kids, like, that should be... I've always thought, like, oh, that should be an option. You know, like,
right.
If, you know, you shouldn't deprive your children of a good mother if another good mother comes along. But the more I thought about it, it's like, well, God calls, you know, like, maybe I'm called to be a deacon, but he's not calling me yet. And he will call me someday soon. If you feel the call, you better respond to it. And
right.
If you respond to it, God will take care of you. I mean, it does, if your wife dies, whatever. He can make up for that.
So, a few things. One is you are correct. So, if you become ordained, and then you happen to become a widower, then you remain celibate. You're mm-hmm. a celibate lifestyle. Oddly enough, this was actually one of my wife's favorite parts of the program. She was like, "Oh yeah, that sounds great." So there are different views of it. A few thoughts though. I would say like, if God's calling you, you go. Just
right.
go. Don't let any
just
fear of anything stop you. You just go and let him figure it out.
Be a man.
Exactly.
I can't believe this is already over. Well, Harrison, thanks for being here with us. Adam will be back together, he and I, next week. In the meantime, we're on the Lord's team, the winning side. So raise your glass. Stay manly.